Now
I can hear you now.
Whew. Okay, sorry about that, having some issues, you know.
Don't let it happen again, Vinny.
Yeah, issues like teenagers, that's what it is on the show, man. Everybody worried about their iPhones and their prescription medication that they steal out of mummy's closet. Okay, now William Klaus is my guest. He's the creator of the Kubrick Transformer. That was directed by Michael Bay. He was the co-host of Always Record with Alan Green and David Plait, and he's an author in the Sync Book 2, and he's a student of James Joyce and Marshall McLuhan. Now, who are James Joyce and Marshall McLuhan? I know who James Joyce is, but you'll have to refresh me, because I think it's been since I was like 16 that I last actually studied him in like high school.
James Joyce and Marshall McLuhan are two voices of the 20th century that seem to have seen further ahead and a much clearer vision than most thinkers. And I think they're very important to my understanding of just what the hell is going on nowadays. So
Marshall McLuhan basically clued you in to what's happening.
McLuhan in, media theorist. The key point about McLuhan for me is the idea of sense ratios and how different forms of media kind of play upon that. You know, like an equalizer for a stereo, Vinny?
Oh, yeah.
You know, a boring music listener, if all their levels are exactly straight in one line, correct? You want to get more bass in there, or maybe a little treble in there. But different forms of media, according to McLuhan, and I tend to agree with him, they move those levels up. So your eyes go up, maybe your ears go down, your taste or your smell or your touch. If you're a print-heavy human being, your equalizer is much different from somebody who is not literate, maybe an older society or a tribal kind of thing.
Well, I consider myself a bit of a treble maker, so I guess it's right up my alley.
A treble maker. You know, I'm just going to let him flow and nod. You're a master at that, my friend. So, yeah, so McLuhan keyed me into this whole idea of sense ratios, and I think this is where a lot of people kind of get their conspiratorial panties in a bunch, because they believe that this was done on purpose, and I don't believe it was. I think it's just a... it's the growing pains of a modern world. So,
So you don't believe in scumbaggery or backroom deals, lying? It's all coincidence.
I believe in scumbaggery. Humans do scumbaggery things, especially when money's involved. But that doesn't mean that it's a conspiracy. If you don't know about
definition,
it,
well, the definition of a conspiracy is really small and really quite simple. It's two or more people coming together to cause harm on another group of people without that group of people knowing about it. Almost everything's a conspiracy.
Well, okay, so I agree with that. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not going down that road of saying conspiracies don't exist. They do.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not the focus of my work or what I try to communicate, because I don't follow the news. Politics makes me sick. I figure 10, 15 years down the road from now is when I'll probably be able to stomach that stuff. So I don't comment on conspiracy. I know it's out there. But I just don't have any answers, and I don't have time for it myself with what I'm researching and what I'm working on. Sort of in that vein, okay?
Well, fair enough. Well, what got you interested in what you're doing in the first place?
You ever heard of instant karma?
Mm-hmm. I insulted one of my friends once when we were walking home from school, then walked it right into a lamppost.
Yeah, something like that, right? I had read a book by Terence McKenna in college. So we're talking about 1994. And this was probably, as you can guess by my college days, messing around with a fungus or two. And had my first psychedelic experience, and I read his book and the way he talked about it, and found a very clear and rational voice who explained a lot about what happened with someone I resonated with. Anyways, he had this thing called the time wave. It was something he constructed based on his psychedelic experiences. But how it emerged from – it came from coincidences, certain things that seemed to connect, but there was no rational reason as to why they connected. And so that book made me think about coincidences just in general. And for some reason, and I think a lot of people can speak to this, around that time, I started to notice this phenomenon that I would call basically instant karma. Whenever I knowingly did something, let's say, take something that I knew wasn't mine, or if a cashier gave me the wrong change and I didn't tell him and I walked out thinking, oh, you know, lucky me, instead of thinking, that poor son of a gun is going to have to pay that back to his business later. I noticed whenever I did those things, immediately after or the next day, something would happen that made me think karma was in action. Now, I don't say that this is scientifically proven, but I started to recognize that when bad things happened, I had a completely different psychological reaction to it if I didn't have something the day before where I felt like I was a douchebag. So it's this whole idea of things happening in conjunction, maybe there's certain meaning to it, made me take instant karma seriously, because with my psychedelic experience in college, I read about, you know, Eastern philosophy as opposed to Western philosophy. I started to integrate all these things in my life, and basically I felt like it was the universe saying, if you're going to start reading about karma, talking about karma, you're going to have to take it seriously, because karma is going to start taking you seriously. So I started to understand karma as it wasn't coincidence, that these were meaningful things happening for a reason. And I started to change my behavior because of that. After my whole experience and my understanding and grappling with instant karma, you know, I started to read about it more often, started to search for books that spoke to the subject. And I think the book that really opened my eyes and ears to the world around me, kind of waking me up, Vinny, out of my slumber, out of my television, fast food, video game kind of coffin, was a book called The Cosmic Trigger by Robert Anton Wilson. Are you familiar with that book?
Oh, I'm not familiar with really any books. I really haven't read a book in quite a number of years. I interview authors instead.
Yeah, you know, you got one side of the coin, but I highly recommend books. Books, pretty awesome. I read this book, The Cosmic Trigger by Robert Anton Wilson, and he mentions something about the 23 phenomenon. Have you ever heard of the 23 Enigma?
I've seen the movie, the number 23 with Jim Carrey, how 23 is in absolutely everything and it drives him freaking crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So a pretty dumb movie, pretty out there subject. But I was going through this in 1995, 96. I read this book. I'm learning about karma, coincidence, and all this stuff. And he relates this story about 23s. And just sort of like I had changed my behaviors and the sort of the wheels of karma seemed to tone themselves down because I was being less of a douchebag. I was opening my eyes. I was becoming more aware. These damn numbers started popping up in everything. 23s, just walking down the street, having a meaningful thought and looking up, and it's 2:30. It just sort of like the movie. Watching movies, seeing them on license plates, on doors, on meaningless objects in the background. It pulled me in with a just sort of a magical awareness. It really it continued to further the opening of my eyes and my ears and my chakras, as maybe people would say. It made me feel like a more aware and alert human being. And you know, if you're going to be alive today, you have to be aware and alert. So it seemed to me like it was a tool, you know, it was a tool for awareness. And every time you saw a 23, it was sort of like, I don't know if you've ever been to a meditation center where everyone's in rows and they're meditating and a Zen master will come from behind and smack you on the shoulders with a stick just to snap you back into awareness, to get you back into your correct posture. So these 23s became sort of like my Zen master in a way. Much like Instant Karma would wake me up to say, you know why there's a nail in your tire and it's flat right now? It's because you acted like a complete douchebag the previous day. It happened so much and so often that it sort of just forced my brain or my mind into a sort of Zen posture, a posture of awareness. And so with that book and with that 23 Enigma, I started traveling down a path that basically has landed me on your show.
Well, this is what I like about Alan and your work is it's based on synchronicity. Things actually do mean things a lot of the time, and sometimes it's just coincidence. And for you, the number's 23. For me, the number's 33, as in the 33 degrees of Freemasonry. And I think this last couple of days have been really big for me, so I'll be on the computer, and then somebody has mentioned something really amazing to me, like, wow, and look at the clock, and it's 33 minutes past the hour. Wow, that's interesting. And then I'll go to import a video, and the exact length of the video that I've imported is 33 minutes and 33 seconds long. And then I'll start processing that video, and the time that I look at it to see how long it's taking, it'll be at 33 minutes, and so on and so forth. It's become quite relentless. In the last couple of months.
I can't escape this
number.
Yeah, who's stalking who? Are you stalking the 33 or is the 33 stalking you?
I think it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B.
Absolutely. So for me, 23 in college was the number that really seemed to kind of open my eyes and ears to this phenomenon. In that book, Cosmic Trigger, I consider that book like a roadmap. Wilson assaults you with so much condensed knowledge and so many names and so many different avenues to go exploring. He talks about Aleister Crowley, Gurdjieff, Philip K. Dick, Terence McKenna, Antonin Artaud, Arbuckminster Fuller, Leary. He addresses subjects like magic, Kabbalah. It's just a grab bag of paths to take to fully explore the different dimensions of this phenomenon that we're talking about. So that was, at that certain point, sort of like almost like a Bible for me. I reread that and read it again. And then because of the glory of the internet, I was able to start buying books by these different authors and starting to read all this stuff. And it almost felt like I was joining a secret society because no one was advertising Robert Anton Wilson. He wasn't on TV. He wasn't in films. These books were not in most of the bookstores. You had to either find them in a random place or order it from the internet. And there was just this magical sense of belonging to a club. And I think the moment where it started to get really freaky for me was one night watching television at around midnight. You know the show Oprah Winfrey?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it's the rerun of Oprah Winfrey. It's about 11:30 at night. And her guest is Jim Carrey. They start to talk about this film that is going to be released in a couple of months. And my jaw drops because he's explaining exactly what's happening to me. This journey of awakening, of the senses opening and trying to figure out that reality isn't exactly as it seems, right? So obviously this movie turns out to be The Truman Show. Pretty huge movie. A lot of people have seen it. Well, it spoke to me in a way that was sort of like, well, this is obvious. People who wrote this movie know Robert Anton Wilson and know these authors. They're in the club. But the moment that really freaked me out was when Carrey starts doing his wild man routine, jumping on the furniture, and then he runs and looks in the camera and says, Illuminati, Illuminati. And this is 1999, and I had only read about the word Illuminati in these books. So to hear Jim Carrey A member, so-called, of the club used that word on Oprah Winfrey really spun me for a bit.
Yeah, I do think that is quite interesting. Even the RZA, who's the one of the chief leads of what was it, the Wu-Tang Clan, I think at a Grammy Awards before he died, he goes and grabs the camera and he says, "The Illuminati are after me. The Illuminati are after me. They're trying to kill me." And then he turns up dead. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. .com. Don't get assassinated by the Illuminati before you get to listen to the rest of the show, ladies and gentlemen. You'll miss out on quite a bit, you know. That's the reason why I don't get assassinated by the Illuminati, because I just don't want to. I'll be right back.
The word is about. There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about a little bit of history repeating. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go frickin' nuts. And I apologise to those of you who are listening who don't have a sense of humour. I pity you, in fact. My very special guest as well is William Claus. Is it pronounced Claus like Santa?
It can be, but usually it's Klaus. So.
Klaus. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Klaus, like the fish in American Dad. Okay. Well, welcome back. And what were we talking about? Sleep. You know, sleep's really important. Last night, one of these people commented on my Facebook status, right? I think my Facebook status was best buddies in prison can finish each other's sentences. And he says to me, what, a non-truth of status? This is about as common as a humane cop or a non-harp-inspired weather event. And, you know, looking back on it now, it was like, oh, it was a joke. But I actually took it the wrong way. You know how sometimes you're like, you know, you're real freaking tired because you've been up for, like, the last week trying to expose scumbaggery and get videos out and that kind of thing. And then somebody says something that's meant to be a joke and you just take it the wrong way and you just kind of blow up and stuff like that. And then when he reminds you, oh, bro, I was just joking, you go, oh, my bad. It's just, you do realize after a while that you've got to take ownership and responsibility for the things that you say and the things that you do. And you've got to understand that, hey, you make mistakes. It's like Mark Passio said, the three words that are required for reaching enlightenment. I was wrong.
Absolutely. I say them all the time. If you get on this path, you know, if you can't laugh, you don't make it very long because it'll drive you nuts. That's for sure. And I think, you know, when I was watching Jim Carrey scream Illuminati on the Oprah Winfrey show, that was the moment where I had my first test. I was like, this is just a big joke. I felt like I had wasted a lot of my time spending a lot of money on books, reading a lot of stupid stuff, because here was this big joke on a huge national television show, a big movie called The Truman Show. It was, you know, it was the universe and the world laughing at me saying, this is no big deal. You know, it was just, I felt embarrassed and I felt like I had been just taken for a ride. And I was pretty much ready to kind of throw away my books and just kind of go about my business and leave this whole coincidence, secret society, different way of thinking nonsense behind. I could keep the instant karma thing. I don't want to be a douchebag. But this path that I was climbing continuously on, it really started to kind of feel silly. Until I had what most people kind of call is like a sink experience, where something very profound and personal, but kind of mundane happened where it all kind of tied everything together. Yeah, have you ever seen the movie Dreamcatcher, Stephen King movie?
Yeah.
So I'm, I go to the movie store with a roommate, and I park my car in a handicapped spot because it's a thunderstorm. And the entire parking lot's full, and I said, we're only going to be in here for 3 minutes, and it doesn't really matter. No big deal. No one's going to complain. I won't get a ticket. Let's run in, run out. We'll make it out. So I put on my blinkers to, you know, pretend like my car is broken or whatever. Run into the video store, rent this movie Dreamcatcher. As I get out to put my car key in the door to make our escape, I drop the key down a sewer.
Oh, no, bro.
So, I'm standing there in the pouring rain. My car's got the blinkers on, and I'm in a handicapped spot. And it's basically the cops are going to probably arrive, give me a ticket. I'm going to have to pay for a tow. I don't have a spare key because I'm a moron. And the whole thing is going to cost me probably $700,
$800, $900. That's the universe fucking with you, yo.
And a week before, I had gotten laid off from my job. So, so I'm sitting there.
It just keeps getting better.
I'm sitting there, and I get inspired and say, no, there's a way. I can do this. For some reason, my roommate's a pretty big guy. He pulls the sewer cap off, but the thing is filled with water. I mean, the keys are submerged. But I, with whatever faith I had left, run into the video store. And I asked them if anyone has a broom, because I had a coat hanger. And I get this broom, and I try to wrap this coat hanger around the broom so I can maybe dunk it into the water and fish out these keys. Well, the coat, because it's pouring rain, the coat hanger does not stay on the broom, right? There's no traction for it. So I run in and see if anyone has any tape. By this point, they're sick of me. I'm soaking wet. I look like a lunatic. And they're pretty much done with my BS. I run to the car. I run to where the sewer cap is. I wrap this thing around as much as I can. I dunk the broom down, and I pull out my keys. It's just a one in a million shot. You can count the odds, but a miracle. It felt like a miracle for a schmuck who just got laid off and didn't have the money to pay for a tow. So I'm obviously pretty excited. We get in the car, we go home. I put on the movie Dreamcatcher by Stephen King. The first scene in that movie features a woman at a store. She goes into the store. She goes out to her car. She realizes she doesn't have her keys. She comes inside. She talks to the person who's behind the counter. The gentleman to her left calmly walks outside to her green car. My car was also green. He reaches into the gutter where the rainwater is, pulls out her keys, hands them to the woman. She drives off in her car. It was at that moment I got pulled 100% back in to this whole mystery of coincidence, because the movie called Dreamcatcher literally had just replayed what happened to me. Now, you can tear it apart. You can say it's not exact. You can say, you know, you're seeing what you want to see into that event. But having lived through it, it was as profound evidence as I'd ever had. It was like I had thrown it away, and then it had come right back to me and said, you need to continue to look at this phenomenon. There's something here that you need to learn. And it was funny. It was hilarious because it's absurd. To try to tell that story to someone, they look at you usually with blank eyes, with very little it's a non-event for someone non-involved. But the power of it subjectively is immense. It felt like the universe was on my side. It felt like the cosmos, that there was an order to things, that there was a reason for things. And this event told me to continue on with whatever it was I was dealing with. And I think it gave me this sort of, it gave me the freedom to just go with it And this is kind of where the James Joyce enters the story, because I found a book at a random bookstore in downtown Chicago called Coincidence by Robert Anton Wilson. And it's in this book he discusses how James Joyce structured pretty much most of Finnegan's Wake and his book Ulysses around the concept of coincidence. And it was at this point where, you know, I had the clown Jim Carrey with Illuminati and the Truman Show. I had the occultists and the freaked out seven people with Robert Anton Wilson and Philip K. Dick and Terrence McKenna. But now I had one of the greatest authors in all of literature somehow pulled into the story. And I had to start to integrate, how the hell does James Joyce fit into this crazy mystery of coincidence? And I think I read that book more times than any book in my life, because it, the essays on Joyce that Robert Anton Wilson has, they're just they're densely packed with a conceptual material that just tests every bit of your cognitive ability. And his source material is respected. So it's when you start to enter into sort of respectable material into this sort of comically jokey, almost comic book kind of body of knowledge, it starts to become more real. And I was thoroughly pulled back into the chase of this mystery with that book and bringing Joyce into the equation.
Well, it's good when things happen like that. They just pull you back into the mystery. And incidentally, it's 10:33:33 right now as I'm speaking. And you know, what it reminded me of is there was this dude named Shane Wenzel. He goes by the name of Tane Rakau, and he's down in suburban South Auckland. And what he does, right, is he goes to protests and he tries to recruit activists to come and work for him. And by work for him, he means he does all his work, and he runs his stuff, and he's trying to set up like this cult, basically. And I didn't know this at the time. And it was one day I was going down to my car, and something tells me, Vinny, you need to learn how to get into that car real freaking quickly, okay? You got to put the key in the lock, open that door, and open the and get in, and then shut it behind you, and turn the car on, and reverse it, and get the heck out of there as quickly as humanly possible. I don't know what was happening, and I did it so quickly that I actually cut myself like across the chest. The edge, the very top edge of the door was a little bit jagged, sort of thing. So I like opened it really quickly and cut myself across the chest. And then I think not a couple of days, maybe even a week later, we go down to this Wenzel character's place because we want to get the hell out of there. My friend, he's got a whole bunch of computer equipment there that he wants to get back. Wenzel wouldn't let him have it back. I was filming him. You know, we went down there with the full intention of exposing this psychopathic, violent piece of trash for exactly what he was. And I was filming him, and then he realized that I was filming him, so he kicked me out of the office, locked the door. And so I started filming from the window, you know, out of the darkness, and see him rough up my mate inside and catch it all on camera. And then they come out, and this big argument kind of ensues, and they actually try to like grab the camera off me and try and delete the footage and things. And my mate stands in front of them and he says, "Vinny, go for the car. Go for the car. Put the key in the lock. Open the door. Get it out of there. Put the car in reverse. Get my mate in there." And then we're out. We're gone. And it was just that moment that I recalled what had happened a week previous, that something was trying to prepare me, something was trying to look out for me, something was trying to keep me safe. And I think it was at that point that I recognized a lot of the importance of what it is that I do, and how I've never worked for anybody since. That was another really important lesson, is that if you get involved with people and if they perceive that you're underneath them, that's something that completely disagrees with me whatsoever. I never work for anybody again. I work with people and with people only.
That's you're lucky if you can do that for the rest of your life. Most of the world doesn't have that privilege, but you got to fight for it, right? You can't just be a passive person and expect that kind of freedom. So, yeah, I applaud. That's definitely the goal with most employment. We got to do it for a long time, most of us, right?
Well, you know, nobody actually has to do it. I mean, oh, wait, no. I don't know anybody who's never been employed, who started off their own business like straight off the bat and then started off being self-employed. I don't know anybody who's done that. I do know that my first job was writing, directing and producing and putting on a play with like about 14 teenagers and things like that to raise money to go to university. I remember that. And I'd never had a job previously before, and that kind of taught me a lot about organizing and things like that. But other than that, every single employment opportunity that I've ever had in my entire life has turned out to be the worst for me. You know, I mean, I've learned some really harsh lessons, and people have just taken advantage or been douchebags or something like that. And I just realized that, hey, it's not me that's actually at fault here. I was actually really good at doing all of this stuff. I was actually really honest and decent and had integrity. It was actually people who employ people that are the problem. It's having a job that is the problem. It's being a slave that is the problem. Never again. Never again. And so, you know, after a number of bad experiences, I developed a I've got about as much evidence for this as every single psychological condition in the diagnostic statistical manual, meaning none. I call it employophobia, because I'm very afraid of being employed, and it's just for this very reason. No employer has ever truly appreciated me and given me just rewards for my unique talents and skills. So hence, I become independent and reward myself for my own talents and skills, and it is in itself its own reward, because I get to help people who really need to have media coverage and so on and so forth, and get to talk to very interesting people like yourself about important stuff that actually matters. All right, we'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show with William Klaus. Back in a minute.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong with the world? People kill people that other people command.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about keeping it bangster. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We gamble on the stock market and so on and so forth just to make sure that the bank accounts are kept full of illegal Illuminati money. And there really is Illuminati money in the States, isn't it? You know, because you've got the all-seeing eye of the Illuminati on the back of every $1 bill. Hey, and I was just wondering, is it just the $1 bill, or is that great seal of the Illuminati on every single note?
Just the one.
Okay.
Just the $1 bill.
Because yeah. It's the most common, isn't it?
Well, it's just it's the start of something big, right?
Oh, yeah.
You got to lead off with your hidden symbols on the number one, so.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about instant karma, and I just made myself an instant coffee. I think there's a little bit of synchronicity in there. And I've also become really attuned. Have you noticed that how once you're aware of synchronicity, you're actually capable of tuning into it and it becomes a lot more intense? It happens more frequently and you're capable of interpreting it faster and more explicitly. Have you noticed that?
100%. I think... You know, this kind of ties in nicely to where I'm at with this because, you know, it's one thing to wake up and realize that there's conspiracy in the world, right? That things aren't what they seem in the government. Politicians generally are just painted faces saying things that are not necessarily the most honest truth. That, you know, this conspiracy exists in the structures of the world, but this mystery of coincidence and synchronicity is the conspiracy of your own mind. That if you can't trust your own mind to process information correctly, then how are you going to speak to the conspiracies in institutions or in other people? And really what this story I'm telling is my recognition and realizing that my brain and my mind, there was a conspiracy going on there, and that these little coincidences and synchronicities were these methods to wake up myself, to look inward and to try to reprogram the original operating system that I was born with or I was given by my culture. So that if I wanted to attack conspiracy, if I wanted to enter into a deeper field, that I could have sort of the psychic equipment to be able to do that to the best of my ability. And I think that sort of reprogramming or that understanding of the operating system that you're born into, it's a short journey for some people. Some people just figure it out and they move on. I was born a Catholic, so it's been very, very difficult and challenging for me to sort of override my Catholic operating system that I was born into.
It was really easy for me to override my Catholic system that I was born into because Mum stopped buying me ice creams, and that was the only reason I went to church. You know, have you noticed that the Catholic Church is based on bribery? It still exists today.
Well, you know, this is the thing, is that I was a pretty bright kid. I definitely distanced myself from my peers as far as where my intelligence level was as a young kid. So I was actually able to, when at church or when confronted with the Bible, read these things from an early age and to process whatever it was that they were trying to communicate. And you take away all the corruption of the church, right? And you take away all the corruption of, you know, the institutions that abuse it. When you get down to it, the Catholic system is heavyweight. It's a beautiful, intricate system that when understood in-depthly can really inform your reality in a positive and beautiful way. You can become a very, very powerful and in touch and in tune person. Saying in touch in Catholic in the same sentence is probably not a good thing, but you can become really in tune to the universe, right?
And I've got a great example here. There was this Catholic preacher, or I'm not sure if it was Catholic. I don't remember. It was just basically, you know, one of these really massive televangelist kind of cult-like leaders, right? And he's sitting there and he's like pretend masturbating on stage by polishing this rod, and it's just like there's this dude who's watching this video. I think it's like it's called the creepiest preacher ever or something. And he's like, when you pretend masturbate on stage, that's a hint. <You know? laughs> he's just sitting there ranting and bashing this guy and bashing Christians for stupidly, you know, falling in line and following these kind of people. And then he says something really profound. He says, if you want to be spiritual, read your frickin' Bible. Don't get somebody else to interpret it for you. Read it yourself. Read a book. What is the problem here? You won't get deceived because the book ain't trying to deceive you. It's trying to tell you the truth. And only people who read it and interpret for you even have the possibility of deceiving you with it. So just read the frickin' book.
Read the book, Vinny. Read the book. It's a good book. It's got some garbage in it. Most books do, but nothing's perfect. Nothing can be perfect, you know what I mean? It's just, it's the way things move, the way things change. That's why we have change in this world. So, yeah, no, I agree with you. Synchronicity and coincidence and instant karma, this is a spiritual journey. And what was nice is that when I turned that lens onto the Catholic operating system that I was born into, I realized that it wasn't all bad. What I was rejecting was just the corruption and the crap that comes with all that money. But really at the heart of it, real solid discipline, definitely made me the person I am today. But, you know, this this process of carving off sort of the tumors that grew into it, it was what I was going through. And it was nice that I didn't have to lose the whole thing. You know what I mean? I didn't have to completely reject and renounce Catholicism, which is which kind of feeds into this whole thing with Joyce, right? James Joyce. You have a Catholic with Joyce, and that informs a lot of his struggle and his spiritual awakening. And really, when I fell into Joyce and this book, Coincidence, by Robert Anton Wilson, I was stuck. I was stuck with Joyce, and Joyce is pretty impenetrable. I could not make sense of the actual texts of Joyce. Ulysses was boring to me. Finnegan's Wake was just a jumble of nonsense to me. Wilson's telling me that it's genius. It's informed by genius. It's informed by maybe the greatest mind of the 20th century, but I was just completely stuck. I started to buy books about Joyce and about Finnegan's Wake and about Ulysses. I bought the annotated Ulysses, but I wasn't getting that crackle of excitement with where I was at. And I remained stuck in that period for a couple of years, maybe about 4 years. I just wasn't really progressing, but I still kind of went back to it and tried to kind of get under the surface. And why was Wilson so excited about Joyce? And then, you know, it's kind of silly, but I became more savvy at the internet, and I started to find blogs and message boards, and I became more interactive with the internet. And that's when I found two websites that completely changed my life. And it's not an exaggeration. The first one was a website run by Lorenzo Haggerty. It's called the Psychedelic Salon. And he runs a podcast where he broadcasts lectures. And he had, at that point, I think it was about 60 lectures in his podcast series, but he had about a 10-episode series of Terence McKenna lectures. So where I begin this tale was in college, reading Terence McKenna. Now I'm starting to hear Terence McKenna speak. And so I find Psychedelic Salon run by Lorenzo Haggerty, and I start to hear the lectures that McKenna gave. And then I found this other website. It's a blog called The Secret Sun. And this is run by a guy named Christopher Knowles. And it was in tandem, this podcast and this blog, that started to crack open or chip away at this impenetrability of Joyce and sort of the concepts that I was dealing with at this point in my process. And if you want to know, you know, I had thought of blogs as a four-letter word at that point in my life. They seemed like the denizens of the geeks and the misfits and the fringe and the throwaways. And in about 4 months, I became a dedicated follower of The Secret Sun and a handful of other blogs. And it was people who were writing and especially comment sections on the blogs. It was like the others. I don't know if you know this quote by Timothy Leary, turn on, tune in, drop out.
Yeah.
But the follow-up to that, someone said, what do we do after we drop out? And Timothy Leary says, find the others. Find the others. And that's what I found with the Psychedelic Salon and the Secret Sun. I found my others. It had taken me a long time, and I wouldn't have found it without the internet, because the subject matter wasn't the stuff that I felt real. My sanity seemed to be exposed when I would bring up these concepts in conversation with regular people. There was a certain safety with the internet, and I started to make comments on these blogs and started to interact with the internet, and it was one of the more exciting periods of my life, is discovering all these other people.
And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break with William Klaus. Don't you go anywhere.